You are listening to the Mick and Mac GAA Football Podcast.
Okay, hello and welcome back to the Mick and Mac GAA Football Podcast. Mac stuffing his face here beside me. Mac, how are you?
I'm grand, Mick. Thanks for that lovely welcome. All's good down here in Cavan. It's turning to be a lovely evening, thank God.
Good stuff. I just caught you there. And delighted to be joined by Enda Williams, all from New York. How are you?
Everything is good. I think I might be making that one. I'm reporting live from the Rockefeller's apartment in Manhattan now, so it might be a bit nicer looking than Belt Harbour.
Yeah. I'm looking at the hospital here, Enda. How can that not get any better?
I'm looking at a piece of artwork in front of me that's probably worth about $17 or $18 million. It's not too bad.
I think you win. Yeah. I suppose, Enda, I'll ask you anyway. Everything seems a bit mad in America at the moment between the protests and the COVID-19, obviously. So how's it all been over there?
Ah, sure. It's very hard to describe, really, to be honest with you, because, you know, it's sort of surreal. And I suppose I'll try and describe it and play a picture for you as clear as I can. You know, it all came on very suddenly. It sort of started off, I suppose, all over the world as a bit of a joke, and we were sort of all making jokes about this virus and the virus. But then after a while, it became very real about how actually serious it was, you know. And I'm in the bartending business here as well. So, like, this Monday, my bar's been closed 13 weeks, you know. And it all started very innocently. I was working on a Sunday night. We had a busy Sunday night. We were talking about it. Now, this is the Sunday before St. Patrick's Day, the biggest drinking session of the year here in New York, you know. And then the governor came on that night, and he said, as of tomorrow at 8 p.m., which was Monday the 16th of March, everything had to close. And originally then, we thought that it was like a two-week period. Everybody was saying two weeks. And now, as I said, 13 weeks this Monday, and we still haven't been in a position where we can open the bars yet, you know.
And have you heard anything about when it may be able to open?
See, it's a like they're talking, we're in phase one of what they call the reopening. Now, hopefully that it runs freely. And by the end of July, maybe, I hope, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
But like, you know, that Monday then, I went in, like my boss, Sean Spratt, like is involved in the bar business for the 40 years, you know, and the bar never closed, you know, even through Hurricane Sandy, even through 9/11, all of the, you know what I mean, the experiences over the last couple of years, and this is the first time he's closing the bar. So like, I met him at 10:30 on the Monday morning, and the two of us are sort of standing there looking at ourselves. Our bar opens at 8 a.m. in the morning. And so we couldn't do anything. Like, we're just standing there looking at ourselves. Neither one of us know what to say to each other. It's like, oh, should we have a beer? And so we ended up tagging one on. And it was like a whole serene feeling the whole day in the bar. It's like all the regulars was in. It's like a local neighborhood bar. All the regulars was in. And you're all there sitting, drinking, having a good old session, you know. And then the next thing at 8 o'clock, we all have to walk out of the bar and close the doors.
Bizarre. Yeah. And I mean, the protests have kind of taken over America at the moment as well. Have you seen much of that in New York City itself?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Like, you know, we went 11 weeks in the virus. And just so that people could understand how bad it really was here, I was doing a night porter's job to try and hustle, you know, and keep trying to make a couple of bucks, you know. And I was doing a night porter's job in my friend's building, Dermot York, who's a great friend of mine here. And Lenox Hill Hospital is two blocks away from us here. Now, my shift was from midnight to 8 a.m. So I was leaving my apartment at like 11 o'clock at night. We're cycling down the streets. Now, for the city that has the, you know what I mean, the persona, the city that doesn't sleep, you're cycling down 3rd Avenue. You don't see one single person. You don't see one single car. The streets are so black because none of the businesses are open. There's no lights on. You cycle up 72nd Street and there's literally two trucks outside the hospital taking dead bodies away. And this wasn't for a night or two. Like, this was consistently going on for 4 or 5 weeks. You know what I mean? Where there's 800 people a day dying of the virus. And like, through the bar business there, I'd know a couple of people, the doctors and nurses that were in the thick of it. And it got to a stage here where they were going into the wars at night time and picking the people that had the best chance to survive to try and give them a chance to survive, because there's so many people in the wards. And like it's a sort of like when you're in the middle of it, you know what I mean? I'm sure you guys probably see it on the news and you probably see how bad it is and or hear how bad it is, but you don't really understand it or appreciate it until it's there in front of you. Like when you can see the two frozen trucks outside the hospital and dead bodies being wheeled into it, you know?
New York is such a mental city in general. I mean, do you think it'll ever go back to the way it was before this COVID crisis?
I always say it's the greatest city in the world, and it's on its knees a bit at the minute, to be honest. It is on its knees a bit at the minute. It's on its knees at the minute. Will it come back? It will, I believe, because of the spirit and because of the history that's behind it. I do, but it's going to take an awful lot of time because we got an awful bathroom. And then, as you said, like, we went 11 weeks consistently with this, and then little bit of light starting to come at the end of the tunnel, like with phase one and that opening, and then should the whole flipping country goes into civil unrest then, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And what's that been like in the streets?
I'll give you an example. So again, my friend Dermot here gave me a job as a security, so he wanted extra security in his building. On the Sunday night, I was working here, so again, my shift was from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. We were lucky. When we closed the bar down, we put up barricades straight away. As soon as the bar was closed, we put up boards. And the next thing at 2:30 in the morning, there was one of my friends that lives up beside the bar, and he's taking a video. And there's 10 guys smashing the liquor store right next door to us. And then the Dunkin' Donuts right next door to us. And then the Best Buy and the Verizon. And there's all this rioting going on. And like, I leave the building here at 4 a.m. in the morning. I cycle up to see if the bar is okay, because it's only 5 or 6 blocks. And there's a poor man there with boxes all over the place, the whole window smashed. And it's like, I'm there. I go into the bar, I get some garbage bags, I bring the garbage bags out. And me and him are standing outside the store at 4:30 in the morning sweeping up the glass. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, it's the first time I ever felt it here in New York. Whereas when I was going to work at nighttime, I actually felt a little bit unsafe, because it was like you could cut the tension with a knife. You know what I mean? It was like, it's so surreal and it's so, you know what I mean? You just don't know. It was just like a bomb that's just nearly ready to explode. And then it was scary. You know what I mean? Instead, I would consider myself a very strong-minded and mentally strong person, but the last, you know, 12 or 13 weeks has been very, very taxing, to be honest.
And can you see any end in sight with all this? I mean, it just seems out of control.
It does, and then, you know what I mean? It's such a delicate topic. Like, you see, I'm not educated enough to speak about racism and stuff like that, because I don't know about it. And I'm not going to be one of these hypocrites to start talking about something that I have no idea of. I can just feel the tension. And then the other thing is, I know nothing about politics, thanks be to God, nor I don't want to know anything about politics. But like, it's like, every day it's a stirring pot, and people are putting stuff in the stirring pot, and they're stirring it and stirring it and stirring it, and it's just like a whole, like New York was all energy and vibrations and music and laughter and energy. Energy is the big word. It's like, the energy is after being sapped over with the virus and now the protests. Like, there's still protesting going on here every single day. It's gone on 15 days in a row now where there's, you know what I mean? And then there's a divide then between, you know what I mean? I have no problem with people doing the protesting, because everybody has the right to say it. But then there's a divide then coming between NYPD and protesters and everything. Like, I always felt safe in New York the last couple of weeks. Maybe not so safe, you know?
Hopefully there's an end in sight. And I'll ask you a bit more about New York GA. So what is your role within that setup?
You know, I was funny enough, Jerry Fox is the current manager of the team over here now. And Jerry is a good friend of mine from my home in Longford. And Dermot York was involved with him, Cormac, Johnny Glynn, former Galway hurler, and Johnny McGeaney and Sean Kelly. So Jerry said to me before Christmas, he said to me, would you... So I'd say there's probably about 55% of the panel now is young Irish-American kids. So he was talking to me and I was delighted for him when he got the job, and he says, you know, will you come back and do a bit of training? And I said, you out of your mind? He says, I'm 35 years of age in March. I didn't kick a football at all last year because I have plantar arthritis in my left hip, so it was giving me awful bother. I says, you're out of your mind. So that was before Christmas. And then Christmas, I was having a good time to do and everything like that. So I had no interest in going to Gaelic Park and getting the shit ran over myself on a Tuesday evening. So then he came back to me in January and he says, will you give it a try? And I began to train before the virus started. So I trained. So I went up the first night and nearly died because I was 15 years older than most of the guys who was there, probably 15 pounds heavier than most of them. I'm like, what in the name of Jesus am I doing here? So anyhow, gradually it built up and I was actually coming reasonably good, and then everything stopped. So there might have been one more fairy tale.
You're going to go for this season?
I was going to try, yeah, but sure. You know what I mean? As I said, my thing was, I looked at it as well, and I said, like, most of these lads are coming in, as I said, it's different like than it was, because, you know, first of all, it's harder to get in and out of the United States now at the minute than it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Like, when I played against Leitrim 2 years ago, sure, we had a star-studded team that time. All lads with Jamie Clark and Neil Collins and, you know what I mean, Tom Kniff, Donald Ward. So we had a star-studded team that time. It's completely different now because of the immigration getting in and out, and then how many people are going to be jumping on the plane now and to come over and play football in New York now?
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose, is the talent pool, as you said, just it's kind of not as good as it was maybe a couple of years ago?
I wouldn't say, do you know what it is? I wouldn't say it's young. You know what I mean? These kids are coming in now. They've went through all the development squads. It's going to take time, and that was something that maybe I thought that I could give being there. Like, whether I would have played or not played this year, I felt like just being there, and it was happening a lot when I was there. Like, the guys would come over and say, look, how would you do this, or what was this experience like? And you might get talking to them, and that was really more of a role that I was sort of trying to play. And I suppose Jerry wanted that out of me as well, so that's why I agreed to go back, you know.
And see, when with your county set up, Mendy, you played for Longford for a number of years, and then you went to Leitrim. How did that move come about?
That was what you call a little bit of a difference of opinion. That was a little bit of a difference of opinion with myself and Glenn Ryan at the time. So then, my father, Lord of Mercy, my father, he's from Ahavas in County Leitrim, and the opportunity arrived. So I could, at the time, through the parental route, I could transfer to Leitrim, and I could play with Leitrim, but I could still play with my club, Clingish. So then it was a no-brainer then. I felt that I could still offer something. So I'm very sort of colourful. I went Longford, Leitrim, Leitrim, Longford, Longford, New York. I'm running out of ideas now. I don't know if there's anywhere else I can go now at the minute.
Cavan.
No, Chris, I couldn't do that. No.
You'd be so lucky. And tell me this, which standard was better, Leitrim, Longford, or was it similar?
Do you know what? Leitrim was brilliant at the time. Do you know why it was? Because we're in modern day Gaelic football, right? And we sort of forget about, you know what I mean, it's an amateur organisation. So we were in a very professional setup at the time with Glenn Ryan. And Glenn was trying to, whatever, you know what I mean, he had good people around him. And Barney Breen and George Dugdale was the manager of Leitrim at the time. Now, these would have been like stalwart Leitrim men, 1994 heroes, whatever like that. And I'll tell you an example. I was all business going down there, and I wanted to try and make an impression. About a month after I went down there, we were going on a training camp to Glasgow for the weekend. So I had a little bit of an injury at the time, and I had a little tweak in my hamstring. And we're getting on the ferry above in Belfast. So I had my little skins on me, looking the part, getting onto the thing. I had a little ice pack underneath my skins. I get onto the boat, Barney's going around, Barney's a great man, and George's great. And I'm drinking my water, and Barney goes to me, what the hell are you doing drinking water? And I says, oh, sure, I have a bit of an injury. He says, well, you get a fucking beer into you there. And he says, we're not going on a training camp for the weekend. He says, yeah, but you know, training camps is about socializing and getting to know your players. So we went over to Glasgow that weekend with the mother and father of a Rick the whole weekend. It was absolutely brilliant. We came back, Mayo kicked the shit out of us in the first round of the Connacht Championship, I think. But then we got a bit of a run out. We won a game, and then we won. Leeds won the first round of the qualifiers, the first time in their history. We beat Wicklow. That was a good Wicklow team. That was with Leighton Glynn and them lads. We beat Wicklow, and then we lost to Leash by a point the following week, and they went on to the All-Ireland semi-final. So there's a lot said for, you know, balance, and you know what I mean? People will say about setups and professional and everything, but you have to, you know what I mean? Maybe I'm old school. Maybe if you're talking to the modern footballers, they might say something different. But you have to leave a little bit of balance into it that you can have a bit of crack as well, you know?
Yeah, and like some of the longer players over the years, your Brian Cavan is even with Mickey Quinn during the week as well. What were them lads like to play with?
Best man ever was Paul Barden.
Yeah.
The greatest. When I was growing up, I had two role models. One was Paul Barden, and he was my own club man. The other was Kieran McGeaney from Armagh. And Paul Barden was head and shoulders. The best way I can describe Paul Barden is, and Paul Barden played with Longford for 15 years. He won 3 or 4 Railway Cups. He represented his country. The year that he retired, I played on for another year or two after that. I had a ritual where I went down. We were playing a home game against Waterford in the National League. And Barden had a blue golf at the time, but he changed it. He'd be cute. He wouldn't tell anybody he changed it. You think he had money, but he changed the golf, and I arrived down. The club were doing their first training session of the year. Now Barden lives in Leeds, so it's an hour's drive away, right? So here's a man, a decorated Gaelic footballer, one of the greatest Gaelic footballers in my opinion of all times. And I walk into the pitch because I'm going around the pitch for a little walk before I went into Pierce Park, and I hear this ball banging off the wall, bang, 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 bang. And I said, who the fuck is this banging ball off the wall? An hour and a half before a club training. And there was Barden down, first man in the training, banging the ball off the wall of his left and right foot. And to be honest with you, that's to me just personifies greatness. You know, he's 30, you know what I mean? He's after having this inter-county career. He's the first man in training. And he's banging the ball off the wall. But Mother of Christ, go into the tackling grid with him and you take the head clean off your shoulders. He burst.
He was a hard worker.
I was 6 and he was 11 for both club and county. So like we were training together all year. And of course then every time that we had to do these flipping tackling grids, Bard would always pull me into the tackling grid. And sure, it wasn't tackling at all, it was going on. It was just pure boxing and mewling. Yeah.
And
killing section.
You mentioned Kieran McGeaney there, and you texted me earlier and said you had a good story about Kieran McGeaney.
I'm telling you now, I know Geezer now. I met Kieran McGeaney when I was 18 years old. And I've been friends with him now. I'm not very good at maths, so 18 and 35. What's that? A couple of 10, I'll tell him, you do the maths for me.
18 and 45.
He's the teacher.
53 years.
Huh?
What's the 18 and what?
35.
So 18 and I'm 35 now. So what's that?
Oh, geez, you put me on the spot here. It's a few years anyway.
Oh, yeah. So anyway.
70.
50. Don't let the Calvin man add better than you, anyway.
He's wrong.
70.
You got it there. Look, the calf man's always good with the numbers, you're saying.
Yeah, they're tight as fuck. They love their money.
Yeah, they're always good with the numbers, you say. So anyway, I met Geezer first in 2003. We had a very good underage team in Clongish. We won the under-14 championship, the under-16, and we were going for the minor championship. And our manager at the time thought we were getting a bit cocky and big-headed, which he was probably right too. But anyway, he said, on Monday evening, Kieran McGeaney's coming down to talk to us. And he says, Kieran McGeaney from Armagh? And he says, yeah. And he said, get the fuck out of here. He's coming down to speak to us. And he said, yeah. So I ran home Friday evening, and as I mentioned, my father, you know, passed away. But anyway, I says to my father at the time, I said, Jesus, Dad, Geezer's coming down. Kieran McGeaney's coming down. He says, I need to get a dictaphone. Get me a dictaphone. And he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck is a dictaphone? He says, this joke that you press, and then when they're talking, you can record it and go back. He says, you owe your fucking mind. I says, no, get the dictaphone for me. Got the dictaphone, and you know, then Geezer talk for an hour, and you know, me like a little schoolboy in the corner, you know, the dictaphone on, every word that was coming out of his mouth. And afterwards then, like he just had, as soon as he walked into the dressing room, he just had an aura about him. Like it was just like an aura, and he still does have that same presence now. But the year previous, we won the Leinster Championship with Longford in 2002 when I was the captain. And I had the number 11 jersey that I walked up the steps to get the cup in. And I had it at home. That jersey meant a lot to me. And after Kieran McGinney was finished talking, I walked up to him. And of course, I nearly shit in my pants when I went up near him anyway. But I walked up to him with this jersey. And my hand was shaking. I was going to give him the... I said, Kieran, I'd like you to have this jersey. And I said, this jersey means an awful lot to me. It's the jersey that I wore in Croke Park last year when we won the Leinster Minor Champs. See, Armagh won the All-Ireland in 2000. We played the All-Ireland semi-final before Armagh played Dublin. And he says, I can't take it off you. And I says, no. I says, you're my role model. I said, I want you to take this jersey and I want you to keep it. And Jesus, then anyway, he took the jersey on him. So he won the Minor Championship on him. And then the week after, I was playing in my first senior final. So the next thing, I come home from senior training on Friday evening, and the phone starts ringing. Now, we hadn't exchanged numbers or nothing like that. The phone starts ringing, and sure, there's no way when you don't know the number, you just let it ring out. You know? So anyway, this voicemail, hey, Enda, Kieran McGinney here. I know you're playing in your first senior final on Sunday. I just wanted to give you a call and wish you the best of luck. And if you want any advice over the next 24, I'm 17 years of age at this stage, 18. Yeah. If you want to ring me for a bit of advice over the next 24 hours, I'll be on the phone. Ah, with the living Jays, I jumped around the room like Santa was after coming to Christmas. And from that day when we exchanged numbers to his wedding down below in Killarney, we were down at the wedding in Killarney, we had some rip down there that day when he got married. Imagine he even smiled when he got married.
Did he? No, he can.
Yeah, he smiled, imagine. I said to him, Jesus, Geister, I said, well, there's creaks coming on your face there. I go out before the ball, but smiling. And to now, it was like just one of the greatest human beings I ever met in my life.
Yeah. And would you been staying in touch with him quite often now?
Yeah. As I said last week there, we my friends over here, I have a great group of friends over here that rode in behind me, and we raised $1,000 for hospice. He's an awful looking whore now with his head shaved.
Yeah.
But no, we'd always text once a week just to see what's going on and touch base. And, you know, what happened with Geezer, the way the relationship was at the start, it was more about football and everything like that. But then as you get a little bit older and you can see, like, you know what I mean, that this football isn't going to last forever and you're trying to develop yourself as a human being and a man, that was probably the most guidance or the most... You know what I mean? Me developing myself into not just being a Gaelic footballer, but always being as good as I can be away from the Gaelic field, and that's where he would have helped me the most.
That's amazing to send you a message like that before a big game for yourself.
17 years of age, we went out and won the county final and drank for about 3 days afterwards. I must have rang him 10 times drunk on the phone. And after the 10th time ringing him on the phone, he says, listen, Enda, stop fucking calling me. I'm happy for you and everything like that, but stop fucking calling me. And then that was it. There no more phone calls after that.
And talk about another Armagh great there. And what was it like to have Jamie Clark in your ranks for a while?
Oh, break your heart. Break your heart. I don't know. Jamie was great. Jamie was probably one of the most naturally gifted men. But I think what we were doing a training session one, like Jamie and me would be friends, like, and he's a great person. He's just sort of like a free spirit. And over here, like, it's, you know, he's chilled out and he loves his little coffee and he wears his nice little skinny jeans and, you know what I mean? He looks the parts through.
Just like Donny. Donny's a spice boy as well.
Let me see the chair on me now. If I can lift my leg up high enough.
I love these skinny jeans, boys, but Jamie was probably one of the most naturally gifted players I've seen. Like, you know, he would do stuff at training that, you know, like, either one of us could try and do 100 times, and maybe between the three of us, we might get it once. Like, Jamie would do stuff naturally with a football, and a great person, and now he is, it's like, you know what I mean, he's done his thing over here in New York, he got his education over here. I wish he had kicked the ball over the bar from 35 yards out when we ran the ball up the field against Leitrim instead of putting it into the goalkeeper's hands. But other than that, he's one of the greatest. And now he has his fashion business set up and everything back to home in Ireland now. So a free spirit and an unbelievably talented Gaelic footballer.
Yeah. Mm. And like, say, like him and Geezer, like, was, I know obviously fairly different people, but was there any similarities of Geezer and Jamie Clark?
Yeah, they both wanted to win.
Yeah. Yeah.
And very, 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 very similar in personality, like very serious both of them. But that's a joke. They're not, they're in no way similar in personality, but they have the same, at the end of the day, this is the way it is, right? Geezer knows that he has a better chance of being successful with Jamie Clark. Jamie Clark knows that he has a better chance of being successful with Geezer Gaydon. Now, obviously, there can be differences of, you know, classes of personality, and that happens in every aspect of life. But the two of them are smart, they're winners, and they know that they need each other to give each other the best chance to be successful. That's probably the best way I can describe it.
Yeah. And I suppose in a more broader sense in New York, how important is the GAA to like the Irish community over there?
That's massive. Like, I'll be honest with you. I have a core group of people over here that I've met. No, I didn't know these people until I came here. Like there's Dermot York from Carrigeven and his wife Siobhan, you know, Cormac McCormack from Ballymahan, you know, Jerry Fox, the manager now in New York, my own boss here. Like, I'll be honest with you. Me here, my own, a single man in New York, like, and after going through everything, without that core base and without that core group, there's probably a realistic chance, I mean, we could be having this podcast and they could be sitting in Ireland, because, you know what I mean? I believe I probably picked up the virus, because after we closed the bar on the Wednesday, I hit rock bottom in a bad way. And, you know what I mean? These people are coming, you know, to the building, leaving food and stuff and medicine and that. And obviously, we couldn't have any communication. But, like, how else was I going to be able to take care of myself if I didn't have these people here with me? And, as I said, probably without them people that I'm after mentioning, and, you know what I mean, there's a good chance I probably might not be here. I wouldn't have been able to survive.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, I mean, is the community kind of growing over the years now?
Absolutely. Yeah, like, you know, when I started off here first, you know what I mean? You know, I met a guy from Kerry, John Reardon. He was an unbelievable human being for me. And then I got involved. I done a sort of a little trick over it. Like, I done a home. I played with Longford here for a couple of years. Then I went to Sligo. Then I trained Kerry. And now I'm back with Longford. So I done a little jig just to make sure that I got to know everybody as well.
You're a social butterfly.
Social butterfly. I have more jerseys at home in the room now. I don't know where they're from.
And obviously with the way the championship is going to be this year because of the COVID, do you still hope that New York would have an involvement, I suppose, in the championship?
In the provincial championship?
Yeah.
I could see that very hard, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because we're, like, since the virus started, like, we had a couple of guys here. We had, you know, Michael Hall, the former under-21 Mayo guy. He was here originally. We had Gavin Joyce from Kildare. We had, like, maybe 7 or 8 guys that had came here and got their visas and everything like that, and they went home. So, like, how to even start it up again and try and get it going again, because, like, we're trying to put some finishing touches on club football, but there's no talk about that maybe, because we're going so directly with the New York guidelines, you know what I mean? And we were in the most pandemic in the world with this virus. So it's like baby steps at the minute. So even where we could get to do a month's training or do training is going to be still very difficult. And as I said, since the virus happened, like, a lot of people like me that were in my position, bartenders, like, what else are you going to do? As I said, I'm just lucky that I know people around me that helped me out and kept me working. Like, New York is a great city, but if you're not making money, it's a very lonely place too. So a lot of them that were bartenders and stuff like that, as soon as the virus happened, they went home. So to even try and have, like, we're even in a position with Longford, and the key players to try and play in a 13-a-side competition just for a bit of fun for the summer, you know, maybe late August or in the middle of August. But it's just because it's such a mass exit that left as soon as word came out of the virus, it would be probably difficult this year to have any competition for New York in the championship.
Well, what about training then? I mean, what phase do you think that can come back into New York, or what's the hope?
So in general context, in club football, they're talking about the clubs have to give an answer by this Monday, whether they're able to participate or whether they want to participate. And I think it would be as best you can participate, like just to have the social outlet again, so lads that can come, play the game, have a few beers afterwards, and just because we've all been so isolated over the last, we haven't seen each other, you know what I mean? Yeah. So even just from that, solely from that aspect, so that has to go through on Monday. So hopefully all the clubs will be able to get 13 players each. And then maybe by the second week in July, you'd look to try and maybe get a small group of whatever, 10 or 15 and train. And then maybe by the first week in August, you might run a club championship for a month or 5 weeks.
Yeah.
But that's obviously, you know, there's no sanctions coming from Ireland or anything like that. So that's just obviously whatever home base you have here to try and build it up and play the games.
And so how are you finding the isolation end of, like, we've done a very good podcast with Sean McCormick, and how are you finding the kind of mentally, as you said a couple of days ago, like, if it wasn't for your mates over there, like, you'd find it hard?
Like, I'd try and paint, like, a home in Ireland is different because, like, you have a house. So you have your house, like, you can go upstairs, you can go downstairs, you go into your back garden, you know what I mean? You have your family there, like, you know, your mother, your father, your brothers, your sisters. You have some sort of interaction. But me personally, I live in a studio apartment in Manhattan. So, like, my whole life here revolved around the bar and the football. And everything was socially active. So then you get the virus, and the only medicine we have for the virus is to stay away from everybody. Mm-hmm. And then it's like you're sitting in the apartment, and I found it difficult, to be honest. I am, you know what I mean, a mentally strong person, but I did find it difficult. And there was times where I was sort of saying to myself, well, you know, fuck this, would I not be better off now just going back to Ireland, you know? But I have a goal over here that, you know what I mean, I want to have my own business in Manhattan. And I'm after having five wonderful years here. So it's like, and my boss was a big part of that, and the guys around me, like, you can't just jump ship because you've hit a bump in the road. No, it was a massive bump in the road, but it was just by keep speaking to them, you know what I mean? And then I just admit it to myself. Some days it's just a shit day. Mm. It's just a shit day. You're in the apartment on your own. You know what I mean? You've no bar. You've no football. You know what I mean? You've no interaction with anybody, and it's just a shit day. And you know what? When I have a shit day, I don't fight it. I just let it be. Yeah. And then whenever it's ready to go, it can go. And yeah, there's been a lot of shit days over the last 11 weeks. Yeah. There is, as I said, these little fundraisers we've been doing over the last couple of weeks where we can do our workout in the morning, do the charity thing, have an old barbecue and a few beers has meant more to me than words can describe. Just being around people and having a laugh and having a joke. But yeah, over the last 11 weeks, there's been a good few shit days, and you just have to try and let your feelings be. And whenever it's ready to go, it'll go, you know.
And how important do you think it is to talk, Enda? Because, like, we see so many mental health campaigns around these days. Like, how important is it to you?
Very important. Like, I lost my father in a car crash when I was 21 years of age. And he was my role model, my idol, you know what I mean? There was only my mother and my brother left over. Like, I had to grow up fairly quick. And for 3 or 4 years, I was playing into county football, and people were looking at me like, oh, Enda Williams, you know, the Gaelic footballer for Longford. But at home and away from it, it was a very depressed Enda Williams, you know what I mean? A very hurt Enda Williams, a very emotional Enda Williams. It was like, you know, we went on then, we won a couple of championships and that afterwards. And, you know what I mean, even now to hear, like, I wish my father was alive and seeing the journey that I took. And I have no problem in talking about that, you know what I mean? But it took me 3 or 4 years. And, you know, I talked a lot with Kieran McGeaney about this type of stuff as well, and other people around me at the time at home in Ireland. And I began then that I was able to, like, I went through a lot of problems back. I can say it now. I couldn't say it then, but I can say it now. Like I would have been drinking a lot, you know what I mean? I went through an awful lot of a phase there. I went on binge drinking, you know what I mean? I just wanted the alcohol to stop me feeling the way I was. I took a period for 2 years where I didn't take a drink at all because I needed to try and understand myself and realize myself. And now I can speak openly and freely about it. But, like, that's what I always say to the young people. Like, if there's anything ever wrong, there's never such a thing as a problem. There's only a solution. Let it out. say how it is, and then there's always somebody there that is willing to try and help. As I said, I hold my hands up here. Over the last 11 weeks, there's been a lot of shit days and hard days. And I just admit it, and yeah, I had a shit day. Hopefully tomorrow will be a better day, you know?
And do you think men are nearly too good at bottling up their feelings?
Absolutely. So we're all as thick as asses. Mm. It's better, I will say one thing. It's a lot better now than it was 10 years ago. It's a lot better now. And the GPA, I'd be a big fan or a big supporter of the GPA. They helped me a lot at the time. Like Desi was the main man there. Siobhan was there. You know what I mean? They were big people and helping me as well. Like, you know, even just to speak about and that. Like, imagine if I had to say 10 years ago about me feeling, somebody would have said, well, you cop yourself on. And, you know what I mean? Stop being such a wussy or a pussy. You know what I mean? But now, I'll openly say, you know what I mean, that I did go through a phase of depression that time after my father died. I did go through a phase of alcoholism after my father died. And thankfully, I have a support around me that me and you can have this conversation openly and freely about now, you know.
Fair play, Enda, fair play.
Enda, tell us about your father then. I mean, it sounds like he was a really important person in your life.
Yeah, I was sure. Like, I was born in Dublin, so here's another part of the story. I was born in Dublin, so I played with Lucan Sarsfields until I was 12, and then we moved down to Lanford. So Lucan Sarsfields was the first club to start off with. So like, he would have brought me, the proudest thing that I could say I'd done was that day in Croke Park when we won the Leinster Championship, and walking up the steps, and I remember walking up the steps, you know, you're only 17 years of age, it's such a surreal thing, like, in you're walking up the steps to lift this cup, and as you're going up the steps, like, you see your father on the way up the steps, and he's crying, you know what I mean? Your mother's standing beside him, she's crying. You're 17 years of age looking at them like, what the fuck are the two of you crying for? we're just after winning the Leinster Championship, you know what I mean? But, like, just the emotion, like, for me, like, as I said, now I wish he was alive and seeing this journey that I took on then the rest of the time, but for that moment that we had in Croke Park, when we won the Leinster Minor Championship, it's just something that, thank God, I'll have that memory for the rest of my life. He supported me, he kept me intact, you know what I mean? He guided me, and, you know what I mean? I miss the living crap out of him every day up until now. I wish he had been around the last couple of weeks that I could have picked up the phone to him and said, listen, because you don't want to ring your mother because she'd be worried, yeah. You know what I mean? Well, I wish I could have picked up the phone and rang my father and, like, what the fuck am I going to do here? But as I said, like, I have wonderful father figures over here, like my boss and Dermot and Cormac and them, that I can pick it up on Jerry and speak to them about and ask. But that moment in Croke Park when he was there, probably the greatest day of my life.
Fair play, Enda. That was a lovely message. I suppose I always like to end on this one, and John knows that. I always like to ask you the best player you played with and the best player you played against over the years.
The best player I played with was definitely Barden.
Barden, yeah.
I wouldn't even have to think about that. Barden was definitely the best player. The best player I played against, so you have a lot of them. When I started off, you had a very young Aidan O'Shea. He was a little bit soft that time when we beat me all that time.
It is.
Leighton, I tell you who was the best player, and he was the toughest motherfucker I ever played against, was Leighton Glynn.
Yeah. Someone said that as well, I think.
We went in to play down in Portlaoise. Now, I was a little bit chunkier at the time, Anya. So the referee goes down to pick up the ball, Anya. I take two steps back because Glenn Ryan at the time had given me the job of man-marking Leighton Glynn. Now, I don't think he had much faith in me that I was going to do a good job, Anya, but I had faith in myself that I was going to do it. So, Anya, the referee goes down, picks up the ball. I take 2 yards back and run through him as hard as I can. Land him flat in his arse in the middle in Portlaoise, right? And he gets up, Anya, and he turns around to me and he goes, is that the way you want to play it today, fat boy? He goes, is that the way you want to play it today? And I says, yeah. I says, we're going to fucking go at this. And what we didn't do between pulling hairs off each other's legs, sticking our fingers up our noses and ears, thumping the living shit out of each other. Now, he never scored a point from play. Good. And he turned around afterwards, and the two of us just fucking, after kicking the living piss out of each other for an hour, we just turned around and embracing each other and started hugging and kissing each other after the game. That's what I respect. I hate these pussies, you know, like that. get all upset if you hit them a clip here and there. And then when you go to shake their hand afterwards, they don't want to shake your hand. But when you have, like when you're thumping the shit out guys in the heat of battle, and then afterwards you can shake each other's hand and give each other a hug and a kiss, I think that's, you know, for me, he was the toughest man in Leighton Glen.
That's all part of the game, isn't it?
That's all part of the game. Everybody wants to win.
And that was brilliant. Thanks so much for doing that.
Now listen to me, here's one thing. Make sure the calf man brings a bit of money. When all of this settles down, right, I want you to come over to New York and do the podcast in the bar. And you know what? Just because you have the calf man, which I'll give you the first round in the house so he won't be crying he didn't get that for free, all right?
That's a deal.
Oh, right. And we'll not thank you for that.
Get that podcast open here. We'll do one in the car, Louise, when all this shit settles down, all right?
Absolutely.
No worries, Enda. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks very much for having me, boys.
Cheers. Thanks, Enda.
Thanks for listening in, and don't forget to follow the Mick and Max GAA Football Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and we are on Spotify.